In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be trying to review some recent events in the Balkans. And our guest for the program is James Soroka. He's professor and director of the Center for Governmental Services at Auburn University. And he's joining us by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. All we ask of people who call in is just they try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along. But anyone's welcome to call, be a part of the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. Also, we do have a toll-free line. That was good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. Any place that signal will travel, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Soroka, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I appreciate it. The thing I'd like to start with is maybe the biggest development of the last couple of weeks, and that was the transfer to The Hague from Serbia of Slobodan Milosevic. And how it is that that was accomplished, it seemed to cause a lot of division back in Belgrade, in the government. In fact, before it happened, the Constitutional Court of Serbia had said that cooperation with The Hague would be illegal. This was accomplished without notifying the current president, Vojislav Koštunica. And now, apparently, one of the after effects has been the resignation of the prime minister, Zoran Djindjic. How exactly did this happen? And perhaps the better question is, why is it that it happened?
Well, the reason why it occurred is quite simple. The world community was meeting to provide a financial aid package to Yugoslavia, and there would not be any financial assistance coming from the European Union, the United States, and others without a full cooperation by Yugoslavia with the International Tribunal.
Mm-hmm. Did the whatever protest there was in Serbia about this and objections to this, how much of that has to do with any remaining support that there might be from Mr. Milosevic, and how much of that really has to do with people's feeling about Serbian autonomy and the fact that if Mr. Milosevic is going to be put on trial, that really that should happen or should have happened in Serbia?
Well, it's rather difficult to say. My general impression is that the street protests and demonstrations were largely organized by those individuals who were somewhat supportive of Mr. Milosevic. But there's a very large contingent of the public opinion in Yugoslavia, particularly in Serbia, that is very much opposed to the concept of the infringement on national sovereignty. In other words, an international tribunal being able to come into another country and take out a citizen of that country and try that person by a set of laws that didn't apply at the time the leader was there. You must remember, this is probably the first time. I'm not positive if it's the first time, but it's the first time that a country has surrendered its national sovereignty. Yugoslavia had stated very strongly that they were going to try Mr. Milosevic for violation of Yugoslav laws while he was president of Serbia. And this is of great concern to the entire world community.
Yeah. It's certainly in the stories about this that I have read, that's what I have read, that is that such a thing has never happened before. No country has ever willingly turned over a former leader to be tried for war crimes.
There's no country that hasn't been defeated in war.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. That's correct. I was interested, you know, because Mr. Djindjic said at the time that this happened, he said things that, for example, he said that this was a difficult but morally correct, his words, I believe, decision to protect the interests of Serbia. And he certainly was very open about the fact that Serbia needed financial assistance from the West, particularly the United States, and that this was one of the conditions. However, what was it then that led him, after having done this and after having stood up and said this was the right thing to do, then to resign?
He resigned under tremendous pressure from his political party. The political party is a nationalist party. It is strong on issues of sovereignty. It's very strong on the issue of Serbian rights in the Balkans and in the world. And in order for him to maintain his credibility both within the party and within the government, he was forced to resign and to take that kind of action. Even Mr. Kostunica, he again is a nationalist first of all. And Mr. Kostunica was not very supportive of this kind of action, but basically stepped in the background and allowed the parliament and the prime minister and the cabinet to take this kind of action. And he has quite vociferously moved himself away from that kind of action. He has not said that it's wrong, but he certainly has not been supportive of the extradition.
Does it create problems for the government there?
Oh, very serious kinds of problems. The current government is a government that is not ideologically consistent. It was a government formed of opposition parties to Mr. Milosevic's socialist party. So they run the entire ideological gamut. They also run a wide range from pro-Western political leaders to very, very strong Serbian nationalists. Some of the members of the government have attacked Mr. Milosevic for being too soft on the Kosovo issue and not resisting more strongly and more intensely over a longer period of time, while others have taken the exact opposite tack. So the government of national unity in Yugoslavia today and in Serbia is not a consistent government and not unified with respect to policy issues, with respect to ideology.
Mm. Certainly, I'm certain that there were many people who felt that Mr. Milosevic should face trial for war crimes, but perhaps in their heart of hearts wondered whether that actually would ever happen. Did it surprise you at all, the fact that the government did indeed send him to The Hague?
Yes, it did. In fact, I was in Champaign-Urbana on Saturday, on the day that the government decided to permit the extradition, and my comment at the point was that this would not occur. My reasoning at that point was that there are too many other members of the current Yugoslav and Serbian government who are potentially also implicated in some of the same war crime activities that Mr. Milosevic is. I'm not sure if there's been any sort of understanding or any deal. I'm not intimating that at all. But I thought it was very unusual that the Yugoslav government so quickly and without public debate agreed to the extradition. Mm-hmm. But again, they were up against a deadline. And when your economy is on the ropes, such as that of Yugoslavia, something had to be done, and something had to be done quickly. Mm.
It's my understanding at this point that the charges against Mr. Milosevic have to do with the conduct of Serbian police and troops in Kosovo. And for the moment, that's what they will be talking about?
Well, if you recall, Mr. Milosevic was officially declared a war criminal at the very beginning of the Kosovan campaign. Mm-hmm. And the charges against him were more heavily allied to issues relating to Bosnia and Mr. Milosevic's alleged knowledge of some of the massacres that occurred at that period of time. One of the issues we have with the International Tribunal is the fact that it is a new tribunal and doesn't have much experience in dealing with these kinds of issues. The rules of evidence are being made up as the tribunal goes along. The judges that are serving in the court are not practiced criminal attorneys. They are international lawyers or judges that have been involved with international issues, but not necessarily criminal issues. This is all new legal territory. Mr. Milosevic, although he has been arraigned, it may be 3 years, maybe longer, before he's brought to trial. And that trial may last for well over a year period of time. There's been considerable concern that the International Tribunal is not well set up to deal with these kinds of issues. The principle that we treasure in the United States, that a person is innocent until proven guilty, is being strained by the International Tribunal, which is working on the assumption, unstated, that these are criminals and what we need to do is find the evidence to prosecute. The prosecutors have been extremely competent. The judges less so and less experienced, and the defense attorneys in many cases have been incompetent on the International Tribunal. This is worrisome to many nations and many political leaders throughout the world, and I think it's something that needs to be addressed. The International Tribunal does stand in very shaky ground in terms of promising a fast and speedy trial. If you have to wait 2-3 years before you can try an individual, what does that mean to the principle that an individual is innocent until proven guilty?
One of the things that I wonder is when, as the trial proceeds, how much of a difficulty for the prosecutors will be the fact that, from time to time, Mr. Milosevic enjoyed the support of the West. He was a signatory to the Dayton Accords. We dealt with him on from leader of one state to leader of another state. How much of difficulty could it pose if he makes the argument that says, look, all the way along, Europe and the United States knew what I was doing and in a sense, endorsed the policies that I had been carrying out in my country.
From a legal perspective, that argument is not going to be very strong. However, from a public opinion perspective, that argument is extremely persuasive. Why would a world leader knowingly and actively bargain with and sign a treaty arrangement with someone that they had considered to be a war criminal? Legally, you can do that. But from a practical perspective of world public opinion, it can be very, very bothersome and very worrisome.
What's to prevent the government of Serbia from turning around and charging the United States or NATO or other European countries with war crimes as a turnabout for the NATO actions that were undertaken, the NATO actions bombing in Serbia during the Kosovo War?
The Yugoslav government has officially made those charges. They have been investigated, and the investigators have said there's not sufficient cause to declare that NATO or the United States or any of the participants in the Kosovan War acted in a way that would have permitted indictments and charges of war crimes. The investigative committee did suggest strongly that there were activities that NATO did do that were less than humanitarian and should be reviewed and examined. But Yugoslavia has already made that case and has lost that case.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus 580 with James Soroka. He's a professor and director of the Center for Governmental Services at Auburn University. And we're talking about recent events in Yugoslavia and in the Balkans. And your questions certainly are welcome. The number, if you'd like to call in, if you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-WILL or 9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. It seems that as interestingly enough, as a result of the action of the Serbian government sending Mr. Milosevic to The Hague, that has caused a number of other dominoes to fall, or at least for people to talk about the possibility that in other of the states in the region, they might indeed start thinking about cooperating with The Hague. And one of the places that there's been a lot of attention devoted to is the Bosnian Serb state, the Republika Srpska, where it is thought, at least, that probably the two guys who are on the top of the list of the most wanted in The Hague are thought to be. That is Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic. And there, the prime minister of the Republika Srpska, Mr. Ivanic, has started talking about the fact that, well, it's possible that something might be worked out, although in a very indefinite sort of a way. He also apparently has said, well, NATO has all these troops in there, and if they wanted to pick up these guys, they could do it anytime they wanted. So there seem to be sort of mixed signals. What do you think the possibility is that sometime in the near future, perhaps, we would see the same thing happen, Mr. Karadzic and Mr. Mladic being turned over by their governments to The Hague?
I don't think you're going to find active cooperation on the part of Srpska Republika to turn over Mr. Karadzic and Mr. Mladic and others to The Hague. However, you may find that they will, you know, protest if such a decision is done, if NATO troops or other troops spirit out Mr. Karadzic or Mr. Mladic, as some of the other war criminals have been spirited out of Bosnia. The real issue is that it is true that NATO could, at any point it wanted, arrest Mr. Karadzic, arrest General Mladic, and take them to the Netherlands. The problem, however, is that in order to accomplish that, there would definitely be some bloodshed.
Hmm.
And again, NATO is there as peacekeepers, not as peacemakers, and there's a very, very strong distinction between one and the other. And unless there's a way that this operation can be done with no bloodshed or close to guarantee of bloodshed, then I think you're going to wait until NATO is just going to wait until an opportunity does open itself up to these kinds of activities.
Hmm.
The government itself in the Bosnian Republic of Serbia doesn't need to cooperate and doesn't have the military resources to do so. If the government said, well, Mr. Mladic should surrender and we will sign the extradition papers and allow NATO troops to go and arrest him, that wouldn't accomplish the fact. There are a large number of individuals armed and experienced who would put their lives on the line to prevent that from occurring.
Mm. Well, it seems as if the idea about Bosnian Serb autonomy there is strong enough so that it would surprise me, I guess, from what little I know, to think that there would be enough people involved in that government who would even consider the idea.
Well, there aren't, and there's no carrot for the Serbian-Bosnian government. It's not a case as in Yugoslavia where $1 billion in aid is on the line.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing that UN Protection Force can offer, that NATO can provide, that would induce the Serb nationalist leaders to violate every single principle they believe in terms of Serbian nationalism and the construction of the Serbian state in Bosnia, that would encourage them to cooperate.
Mm-hmm. It seems that Mr. Ivanic has said, I believe that I recall hearing comments attributed to him both saying, as I did, that he said, well, you got 20,000 NATO troops there. I only have 8,000 police officers. You want to pick these guys up, go ahead and do it. And then on the other hand, and saying something like, well, but we're not really sure that they're here anyway. As far as anybody knows, are they indeed living somewhere in the Republika Srpska?
Generally, yes. People do know that. Mm-hmm. They do move around from location to location. Whether or not they know where they are on a particular time or whether or not the NATO troops could come and arrest them at any particular moment, that's a logistical decision that needs to be made with advanced intelligence, et cetera, which is beyond our purview and, mm-hmm. and our understanding. The Serbian-Bosnian government effectively has to make the statement saying that, yes, go ahead and arrest them if you know where they are. But we don't have any guarantee, then we don't know where they are. If they had said, we know where they are, they're harboring a fugitive, and in that context, every member of the Serbian government could also be brought, although I doubt it, before the War Crimes Tribunal for violation of international law.
Mm. Well, we have some callers. Why don't we talk with them? Let's start with our toll-free line here, line number 4. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. With all this going on in the Balkans and all, I'm for it too that they are called to responsibility for all their terrible things. But what really bothers me all those years, and I would like to know what the gentleman thinks about this, all those murders which happened with refugees from Silesia, from Eastern Germany, and from all, it was a carnage there too. When they, how come nobody ever talks about this, and how come nothing is done to get these war criminals too? That means certain people from Russia and from the Czech Republic and all that. It really bothers me very much that nothing is done to find these criminals who did so terrible things to the refugees.
There's a major difference between the tragedies that have occurred throughout much of the Soviet Union, Eastern and Central Europe, and what occurred in the Balkans. And what occurred in the Balkans was a military operation where the rules of war were suspended, where human rights were violated in a systemic manner in a way to force either the eviction or the death and destruction of entire parts of populations based solely on the fact that they belong to one ethnic or national group or another. I agree with you. The tragedies that we've seen in the 20th century in Europe are unforgivable in many ways. But the practical reality is that it would be not only extremely difficult, it would be impossible to bring all of those to justice. You know, people like Joseph Stalin are dead. You can't bring them to justice.
No, but like 40 years ago, people here didn't even know about these things.
That's
you know?
Correct.
When I came first here, we talked about things. They didn't even know. Why was it all kept quiet? Because it was, you know, it was the Germans started the war and all. I say nothing, you know, that's true. But these people were innocent refugees, and I mean, I read books. It's unbelievable. Just the same what you saw with in Yugoslavia, you know.
Well, a perspective, and this is not terribly comforting, but is practically important, is that it wasn't until after 1990 that the world community, or the world community in Europe and North America, had the capacity to be able to enforce human rights standards and to enforce the laws and criminal penalties against genocide in the world. In 1945, 1955, 1968, and beyond, the world community didn't have the capacity to do that. Mm. And at least, you know, from the perspective that the world is united on this process and is working towards limiting the ability of world leaders and military leaders to, on the basis of nationalism, religion, and other basic characteristics, commit genocide against part of their population and their citizenry, is a major step forward in human rights. But again, it's just one step. And I agree with you, it's taken much too long to accomplish that first step.
Yeah, I think it's one-sided somehow. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Yeah. Let's continue. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign County on line 1. Hello.
Yeah, I'm hard to figure out how to follow that because I recall that the crimes of the Russians, maybe not in their particularities, but were widely commented on through the last several decades. And it's also the case that the U.S. does not want to participate in an international court if it isn't one that it can control. I mean, it's very clear when you were describing Serbia not wanting to have people subject to international court. Some of those words and phrases can be applied to the U.S. because it doesn't want to be involved in the other court that would be set up with a little less control. This was commented on just recently by Steve Erlinger of the New York Times, which is surprisingly frank in talking about this court as a victor's court. And a while back there was a rumor that Akin Ketu, I don't know if I'm getting the pronunciation quite close, but he's an Albanian that was working with Wesley Clark during the dispossession of the Krajina Serbs from Croatia, and supposedly he was cited for war crimes there and other places, but he went on to be very high up in the KLA, and I think he's probably still in the government, and I don't think the envelope was ever opened, if indeed there was something. So what I'm getting at is it's very clear that this is a victor's court, and for all of the justice that should be served against Milosevic, they're worthy victims, basically. I mean, the people the U.S. wants to get are the people they're going to get got, I'm afraid. And I also have heard that some Greek parliamentarians have filed another complaint against NATO, if I recall. It's not getting a lot of press coverage here, and I think that would go to The Hague, too, but not to the the court with Carlo Ponti. Mm-hmm. And well, anyway, I just wanted to get that in, and I have to go, and I'll listen to whatever sort of spin you'll like to put on it off the air.
All right. Well, Professor Soroka?
The reality is that, yes, it is a victor's court. The United States would not agree to surrender its sovereignty and allow extradition of political leaders that others might have accused of being involved in war crimes. However, you really have to take a look at what's at stake here, and what's been done, and to whom, and whether it was done in a systematic way to carry out genocide and crimes against humanity. If, for example, in the course of the military war in Kosovo, innocent civilians were bombed, that indeed is tragic. It is regrettable. It is something that we hope could be avoided in the future. But is it a crime against humanity? I think under those circumstances, you'd have to say it's of a totally different dimension than actively planning the mass exodus and expulsion of an entire ethnic group based upon their national origin and background. The world's not a perfect place, and the Hague Tribunal is not a perfect court in this respect, but that doesn't mean that we do nothing until such time as we create a perfect world, in which case nothing would ever be done, which has been the case since 1648 and the Treaty of Westphalia that set up the system that we're now operating under. Mm.
Let's talk about Croatia for a moment, because Serbia, Serbs have long complained that when we talk about Balkan war crimes, it seems that most often the perpetrators are said to be Serb. And the Serbs have argued that crimes have been committed against Serbs. One of those places was in the Krajina, the region of Croatia, where Serbs who had been living there for a long time were driven out. Just recently, and perhaps again, we can trace this to the fact that Mr. Milosevic is now in The Hague, the government of Croatia has agreed to send two people who had been indicted for war crimes, two Croatians, to The Hague. And it caused a similar sort of difficulty with the government in Croatia. But one wonders if, first of all, if this would have happened had not Mr. Milosevic gone first, and that whether indeed we're going to see some more attention placed on Croatians and what happened in Croatia during the early stages of the Balkan Wars.
You are going to see more attention paid to that. You are going to see a lot of attention paid to that. All those who committed war crimes for which there are open or sealed indictments be brought to justice. The issue in Croatia is extremely interesting. Generals Rahim Ademi and Ante Gotovina both were involved in the Croatian army. Both were involved in the Krajina and are both alleged to have participated in war crimes, mass expulsion of the Serbs from the Krajina in Croatia. I believe as of yesterday, General Ademi has agreed to surrender and be turned over to The Hague. General Gotovina has not. Within the country, the political leaders of the Croatian Democratic Community, the HDZ, are meeting with the and have been seen publicly meeting with some of the other Croatian army generals to strongly push that under no circumstances can The Hague put Croatia on trial or to bring into question, the exact words are, the legitimacy and legality of the liberation war and its operations into questions. In other words, that whatever indictments and whatever trial occurs, these will be trials that relate to individual actions done by individual military officers, ostensibly acting under orders, but probably exceeding those kinds of orders. It's a real fine point. It is likely to bring down the Croatian government, but it's a necessary kind of point. Our previous caller had mentioned about some of the problems with the KLA and the Albanian ethnic minority in Kosovo and their potential involvement in war crimes and in crimes against humanity. It's there, and to be consistent, The Hague is going to have to follow from country to country, region to region, group to group, and create the principle that if you create a crime against humanity, regardless of your own national origin and your own country, you will be brought to justice.
Mm-hmm. Now, previously, as I understand it, Croatia did hand over to The Hague some Bosnian Croats who were indicted, but this would have been be the first time that that Croatian leaders,
who were Croatian generals working under the Croatian military command, have been brought over. And again, only one of them has agreed to be extradited; the other has not yet done so at this point. This is bringing out demonstrations, granted not as large as some people had anticipated in Zagreb and other places, and it brings into question the issue we're asking. What is the nature of national sovereignty? Who should be responsible for these crimes and bringing these people to justice?
Mm-hmm. I know that there are people who felt that the former Croatian president, Franjo Tuđman, who died right at the end of 1999, was perhaps equally guilty, as guilty as Slobodan Milosevic, of war crimes, and should have been put on trial. And he apparently was under investigation, but died, and so that ended that. Do you think that if Franjo Tuđman, we're doing one of those what if sort of games, but if Franjo Tuđman was still alive, would you expect that at some point he would have also gone to The Hague?
I don't think so.
No.
The relationship between what Croatia did and Croatia's experience in the war and Serbian experiences are different in terms of intensity, not necessarily with respect to the quality or the intensity of the crime, but just how much, where, over what period of time. The issue you have with Milosevic is not that he personally ordered The death and destruction, for example, of the Bosnian Muslims at Srebrenica or other places, but that he did nothing to stop these activities and that he put in together a command structure and a political policy that led others to commit those kinds of crimes. Mr. Tuđman did not go to that extreme, and I think there is a difference at least in terms of scope, between Mr. Milosevic and that of Mr. Tuđman.
Mm-hmm. I think it's correct to say that Croatia is perhaps the most Western-leaning government of those states that were Yugoslavia, and certainly even before it was Croatia and Slovenia were the two most leaning towards Europe, and seemed that when you talk about the forces that pulled Yugoslavia apart, it was partly their leaning towards the West and the government of Serbia and Mr. Milosevic leaning towards the East, and that sort of helped to pull the whole country apart. Is Croatia's interest here in indeed doing what it can to solidify its relationship with Europe?
Oh, definitely, it's trying to. It's best to eventually become a member of NATO and become a member of the European Union. But Croatia traditionally has been more Western leaning. It is closer to the centers of Western commerce and business and industry than Belgrade is, and in southern Serbia. But there's also a difference in leadership. Croatia's government under Ivo Račan and Stipe Mesić, the president of Croatia, have made a very, very conscious decision to extricate themselves and the government and Croatian society from the tragedies of the Balkan Wars. They've made very conscious and very difficult decisions to say we will cooperate with the Western governments and the community in order to become an integral part of Europe. The dramatic change since December 1999, when Franjo Tuđman died, and today is remarkable. These are people who have exercised great courage in leading their nation and to make these kind of critical decisions. I think they need to be praised. Now, Mr. Kostunica is much newer in as a political leader in Yugoslavia and in Serbia. The forces that brought him to power were much different than the cases of Mr. Račan and Mesić in Croatia. But the progress is moving in the same direction. But again, from the Serbian perspective, there's a lot more accommodations that have to be made. There's many more questions that have to be asked, and there are many policies that have to be fully faced if they're going to join the European Community of Nations.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with James Soroka from Auburn University. We're talking about recent events in the Balkans, and questions are welcome. We have somebody here ready to go. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455. And then there is that toll-free line. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that one, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Let me just set up a hypothetical situation here. Suppose I kill my wife for no reason, not out of self-defense or anything else, and my next-door neighbor, he kills his wife too, and for the same lack of reason. But suppose that I'm put on trial for that crime and that he isn't, and then suppose that he is allowed to be a judge or maybe, you know, a juror or whatever in my trial. My question to you, sir, is what kind of justice system would you call that?
Oh, that's not a system of justice, but that's not the...
That's right, it's not.
That's
See
not
you
the
later.
Situation we're seeing in the Balkans.
Well, I guess the the caller fired her shot and then left. You would take exception with his parallel there between that situation and the situation in the Balkans.
Correct. In fact, I'm not sure who would be considered to, to be the neighbor who serves on the jury. I mean, that's certainly not Croatia or Macedonia or any other inheritors of the Yugoslav state.
Well, I would expect that he would be going back to those people who might make the objection that the United States, in its conduct, particularly during the Kosovo War, committed crimes, and that essentially the court is if not friend, if not our creation, then is friendly to us. It's in a sense, I think, the same points that we've touched on already.
Right. And the court is certainly not our creation. We opposed the initial proposals to set up the International Tribunal, and we put some strong stipulations in terms of its operating procedures and rules of evidence, et cetera, for the International Tribunal. The United States is very worried about, the precedent this is setting up, but to a large extent, the International Tribunal is a United Nations creation that, can at some future date potentially impact issues of sovereignty in the United States.
Well, let's take another caller. This is also Champagne, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
That was a rather interesting call. I think all this talk of miscarriage of justice is rather specious because law in and of itself is more about the enforcement of consequences than it is about any bizarro notion of justice, unfortunately. And I want to point out that the United States is involved in a sovereignty struggle over the commission of just criminal acts by our military forces in foreign countries. And this is a large issue, but justice is being served. And I think this is a good thing. I think that Croatia, while they can't turn front, Tushman or whatever his name
they
was.
They can't raise him from the grave.
Right. I mean, that man was definitely guilty of war crime, and there's a difference between fighting a war, and let's say that the Serbians put their listening post in the Chinese embassy, so this is just typical Sino-American politics. I mean, there's a lot of finger-pointing, but war crimes are war crimes. Torture is torture. Rape is rape. The shooting of civilians is the shooting of civilians. These are war crimes. Bombing the Chinese embassy, allegedly, but come on, there was a reason why our forces bombed it. Whether or not they're going to admit it, they knew exactly what that building was. And so that's all I have to say, and I think this is great. I mean, it'd be nice if we could go back in time and, maybe, eventually they can have trials like this in Rwanda and, Cambodia. So that's all I've got to say, and thank you.
Okay. Any further comment you want to make on that?
The whole issue of crime and justice also has the question of intent. What is the intent of a policy? If the intent, and this is what The Hague is all about, to carry out a policy of genocide or decimation or the removal of a people because they are a people and not for what they have done, then that is a crime against humanity. If through a military technology, people are injured, it wasn't the intent of the tactical strike, for example, to kill the Chinese diplomats in Belgrade. It's at a totally different level. If the intent was on the part of military planners to hit the Chinese embassy or to selectively kill or force the evacuation of an entire class of people because of who they are or how they were born, that indeed then is a crime against humanity, but the other is not.
We have a couple of minutes left, and I guess I wanted to try, not very much time, but to touch real quickly on Macedonia, as there is another place where there's concern that conflict that has been going on now there might grow and might involve some of the states around there that have Albanian minorities living in them. The concern here, or the issue here, is that something like a third of the population of Macedonia is Albanian, and these people say that they have been discriminated against. They're battling for equal rights, and there also is a military campaign going on involving Albanian rebels fighting against forces of the Macedonian government. And now there continues to be an effort by the outside, by Westerners, to try to broker some sort of peace here between the two sides and dampen down this fighting before it gets any worse. And the possibility of then, if an agreement can be reached, sending in NATO troops just long enough to try to disarm the rebels and then leave. What do you think that we're going to see happening there?
Well, in 30 seconds, it's really difficult to solve the problems of that part of the world. The basic issue, and this is very difficult for a U.S. audience to understand, is that there are no good guys and no bad guys in these kinds of arrangements. The Albanians may have been our heroes in the Kosovan War, but that doesn't mean that their intentions were pure and their policies are democratic and humanitarian. At the same time, the Macedonians were our allies and friends during the last 10 years, and no way to argue the same kind of point. Both sides have made mistakes. The possibility of brokering an agreement, I think, at this point is quite remote. The Macedonian government has tried for the last 10 years to do its best to create a situation where both ethnic groups can live in peace. Mm. It's not a simple situation, and I think it would be unfair to characterize the Macedonian constitution and government as being exploitive or engaged in activities that discriminated against the Albanian population. There are issues and symbols that could be, but in most cases, they've behaved quite correctly.
My apologies for both interrupting you there and for not really giving you enough time to answer the question, but we're simply going to have to stop. Professor Soroka, thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Our guest, James Soroka from Auburn University.